Our next presenter this morning is Dr. Rita Shane. Dr. Shane is Chief Pharmacy Officer at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center and Assistant Dean, Clinical Pharmacy Services at the University of California, San Francisco School of Pharmacy. Dr. Shane was named as one of the 50 experts leading the field of patient safety in the 2013 Becker Hospital Review, and was the 2012 recipient of the Harvey A.K. Whitney Award. She has also been recognized as California Society of Health System Pharmacists, Pharmacist of the Year, and received the ASHP Distinguished Service Award, the ASHP Distinguished Leadership Award, and the John Webb Professorship in Hospital Pharmacy on Management Excellence. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Shane, who will present What is Health System Pharmacy's Contribution to the Value Equation?
So much for the honor of being here and following Quinn McKenna. I think we all want to be Linda Tyler. How many of you don't want to be Linda Tyler after hearing that resounding presentation? So what did he leave us with? The concept of understanding, alignment, and relevance. And I think as we think about the topic that I've been asked to speak about today, that's really what we need to think about. How can we be relevant? What are the high impact areas? We need to have a disciplined focus, we need to have accountability, and we need to have results. And essentially that's what he showed us, and I'm going to try to kind of translate his concept into the perspective I chose and some of the examples I chose to try to share that with you today. And the things that I'm sharing are probably being done in your organizations as well. I don't think I'm inventing anything new, but maybe I package it a little differently and really try to make it relevant in the context of what we're experiencing every day in our healthcare organization. So I'm pleased to have followed him. It's always a privilege to speak after him. And hopefully I can tie into some of the things he said, as well as some of the comments that Chris made during her introductions in terms of ASHP's focus. So hopefully we're all aligned, and we can continue to demonstrate our relevance and our value. So here are the objectives. I don't need to go through them for you, but clearly we're in the shifting world from volume, which has really driven our organizations, particularly in the ambulatory areas where we're going to continue to focus as we look at patients as the center of what we do, as opposed to episodes of care. And the focus is really on value. And last but not least, in our organization, I'm sure of all of yours, it's all about results. We have to be able to show results, which is what we've seen in the last presentation. So when we think about how a lot of us grew up, and me in particular, I've been around for a long time, the traditional acute care system focused on taking care of that episode of care. And the CEO of Kaiser, who is a well-known to one of our people here, Dave Kavance, said that we're in the business of selling a package of care, not pieces of it. And I think that for the better part of the last 30, 40 years, we've really been about taking care of pieces of care, episodes of care, reacting to an acute care episode. And we know that that's not going to work in the future. And certainly within the pharmacy realm, although we have advanced clinical practice over the last 50, 60 years, starting with the ninth floor project at UCSF, we really were still reacting to episodes of care. And sometimes I say to my staff, you know, I know we do a lot of work clinically, but we're kind of in transaction-based business. And what we do across the pharmacy enterprise is a lot more than transactions, but yet sometimes that's what we're perceived as doing. Outpatient revenue has been a very, very effective way of sustaining and maintaining our organizations, especially those of us in large teaching hospitals with a huge infrastructure, and oral medications for many, many years were the mainstay of chronic disease management. And they're becoming that way as well. We looked just at the advances in oral chemotherapy. But clearly, patient-centered care is the new mantra. It's the vernacular we need to focus on. And we need to think about how pharmacy needs to change to really meet the needs of patients. Team-based care is well established. You may have seen, we were all thrilled to see the article that came out, the position paper last year, where the American College of Physicians formally acknowledged that teams are responsible for the care of patients, and pharmacists were explicitly mentioned in that position paper that appeared in the Annals of Internal Medicine. Preventing readmissions, we've heard about transitions of care and the like. I'll talk some more about this. And the focus is going to be on outpatient costs. How many of you have been asked to be involved in the discussion about risk-based contracts? Raise your hand. Quite a few. Well, once you get into these discussions, outpatients become a cost center, no longer that magical thing we call revenue. And again, specialty medications, which which Quinn mentioned, it's the top of the, I bet if I asked you how many of you are thinking about specialty medications, most of you would raise your hand. And if you're not thinking about it now, you will by the time I'm done. Because that's the name of the game. It's driving costs. It's giving everybody in across the healthcare sector, whether it's the health plan, the employer, or any aspect of the healthcare provider system is thinking about specialty medications, or if they're not, they're just thinking about the costs. So we've heard the term pop health. I don't need to repeat that. All of us in our different geographic areas are scrambling to accumulate as many patients as possible so we can have a sustainable organization to provide healthcare services and keep patients well and make sure the sickest ones get the highest level of care so that we can continue to keep them out of our hospitals. Anybody not doing that? So it's all about let's buy everybody or anybody we can. Sometimes I think it's strategic, sometimes I wonder. But that being said, it is about creating an infrastructure to provide care because we want to be like Kaiser and we want to be like the VAs and we want to be able to be an integrated health system. And some of you who I haven't named who are integrated systems, I apologize. I wasn't prepared to come up here and name all of them, but truly to be able to care for a patient population, we need to be able to have a larger number of patients so we can really organize ourselves around ensuring that we provide the patient what they need at the level that they need it, in the setting that they need it. And risk-based contracting really pushes that sort of discussion forward. A risk-based contract means that the health system is going to be at risk. Dollars on the table that are going to affect the way we treat patients. And I'll talk a little bit more about this, especially as we get into some of the work that's being done already on episode-based care or bundled payments, because that is the future. But certainly, once we get into this realm, there are significant implications for how we as pharmacy become relevant in those types of contracts and how we actually need to be at the table as those contracts are being crafted. Now, how many of you had an opportunity to participate in discussions with payers on contracts so far? Anybody? Some of you have. It's a very interesting discussion. They have no understanding of our world, and it's an opportunity, just as Quinn said, to educate. So my belief is we have to educate as many people as we can outside of our realm to get an understanding of the many dimensions of the complex things we do every day for our patients. And if we can't educate them, my plan B is exhaust them, because eventually they'll realize it's important because they can't understand it. So I always say if education doesn't work, I just talk enough till people get tired, and usually by then I wear them down. So whatever works, you've got to be relevant, right? Focusing on efficiency and costs, readmissions, length of stay. Who is not working on this in their organization? Anybody? I think this is pretty much the name of the game. And then we've seen, we've talked about mergers and acquisitions more than once this morning, metamorphosis of the retail sector. So most of us these days have heartburn over this because we're watching the reinvention of the retail sector. It's the biggest level of disruptive innovation we've seen in our careers as they too position themselves for population health and aligning themselves with employers and plans to take care of populations. And they're really expanding their reach in many, many sectors. Hospital retail partnerships are going to be interesting to watch. In some markets, they may make sense, depending on how one is aligned. In other markets, organizations want to be able to be the one who provides the care. And how those relationships are developed is something that we, as a profession, have to really think about and structure in a way that makes sense for our patients. Because the values have to be aligned, whether it's a partnership with a retail entity, an infusion center or some sort of clinic, the values have to be aligned, as well as the nature of the financial aspects of the partnerships. And so this is an area that a number of us are spending time on thinking about and really understanding what this means to our organizations. So how many people have been approached by one of the W's or the other, call it the W's, or any of the other people in the retail sector? I'm not here to discuss this in length. How many people have been approached? How many people have put together content to just talk about what does this mean, where does it make sense for us, where doesn't it? How many people have actually started to put content together? Well, if you haven't, hopefully, in the future as we continue dialogue, that'll be something to talk about. Clearly, these are our community colleagues and us do need to find a way to make patient-centered care the area of focus we all focus on, and hopefully we'll find a way to make that happen. But I think that's really important and it's relevant and it has it does bring value, but we need to make sure we do it in a way that's collaborative. And I think anyone in the room would agree to that. So clearly lots of changes coming. And then we've got our feet in two different places. So this whole notion of the outpatient world is really changing quickly, especially as we go into risk-based contracting. So historically, cancer centers, specialty drugs, diagnostics, and procedures, volume generated revenue, which was essential to the overall financial bottom line for our healthcare organizations, for those of us who have systems with all these programs in place. But we really are kind of got our foot in both doors. On the one hand, maybe there's still some revenue to be made, and that's not inconsequential by any means. But at the same time, the risks are not insignificant. The risk-based contracts mean we're at risk for the whole thing, not just just generating revenue based on each activity, each patient we see, each specialty prescription we fill. And then there's this whole new area of therapeutic imaging. Has anyone gotten involved in that yet? Therapeutic imaging. When you look at some of the entities that are available that are imaging agents, they would technically not fall under normal circumstances as something we think of therapy. But if you start to look over that wall into imaging, a lot of the products they're using have therapeutic implications, and where they fall into the treatment of cancer or other diseases is really important. And as we get into targeted therapies, the diagnostic components of that will help support which times to use certain agents are going to be critical, whether it's a laboratory agent or an imaging agent. So within my organization, I'm saying we need to develop the expertise in these entities. In the past, we might have, our first foray was with pharmacogenomics of warfarin. We weren't that impressed with it. Even the meta-analysis that just came out demonstrated that it really wasn't all that effective as really a predictor for warfarin dosing. But these days, these diagnostic and therapeutic agents are going to be very, very critical in determining how we use our resources. And if you put in a risk-based contract on top of that, it's up to us. Because the payers are going to say, frankly, my dear, for those of you who remember Gone with the Wind, I don't give a what, I don't want to use the word, the four-letter word that begins with D up here. So it's really going to be up to us to decide. So we're going to need to apply the evidence-based guidelines to the diagnostics to go with the targeted therapies. And that's really part of the future that we can look for. But in the meantime, we've got our foot in both sides. And having this dialogue with our oncologists or some of our physicians in inflammatory bowel disease is always really very interesting, because they're saying, well, you don't want us to use the more expensive agent that just came out for IBD, so do you want us to go infuse it somewhere else? Well, no, we don't want to do that, because we still want to keep that volume. But in the future state, we really have to be very, very critical about how expensive agents are used and what is the therapeutic decision-making around these specialty drugs. Even in the absence of biosimilars, there are therapeutic equivalents that need to be assessed to determine which drug makes sense for which patient. And I'll show you some data and some work being done by that in the real world. So a number of us grew up in this world of drug expenses, the traditional health system pharmacy role. If you think about the walls in which we practice acute care, our focus was really about let's try to keep the drug expenses, let's keep the drug expenses as low as possible. And although historically drug revenue was something that we were able to achieve through outpatient programs, and I would still say this isn't actually going down, this is really the future. The future is going to be reduced drug revenue, increased drug risk. And this is where we really have to position ourselves to create value. We have to continue to do this, but we also have to really be aware of what these things mean, because we have to help our organizations understand what drug risk is. Because in my dialogue with the payers, what I hear from them is that they really don't understand what goes on in health system practice. They don't understand that organizations like yours and mine have really worked and endeavored to develop management utilization guidelines to ensure that the medications that are used appropriately, that we're doing things like Linda Tyler is doing, where if a drug can be given outpatient, we actually talk to the physician and say, don't give it inpatient, give it outpatient, where we really endeavor to, what I would say, manage utilization across the health system, and that drug revenue is something that has this kind of evanescent few more years probably, but in the future under global contracts or risk-based contracts, it's not going to really matter. The revenue is going to go away. So when we look at healthcare problems, back in 1998, a physician by the name of Mark Chasson, if that name rings a bell, it's because he's the current CEO of the Joint Commission, was involved in a blue ribbon committee for the Institute of Medicine on healthcare quality. And that committee concluded that there are three kinds of quality problems: overuse, underuse, and misuse. And they all affect the quality of care, the safety with which we deliver care, and costs. Well, guess what happens when you look at medications? They fall into all of these. This is not rocket science. If you think about all the issues we think about in our healthcare settings around medication use, it falls into all of these. And in fact, just recently there was a, okay, now I'm not advancing correctly. Recently there was an IMS report that actually tried to quantify what overuse means to the tune of $213 billion. Representing all the things we would expect: outpatient visits, prescriptions, and needless emergency department visits. And then they identified opportunities where we as a healthcare system, and I think these were absolutely relevant for us who are in the pharmacy profession, can actually make a huge difference. And I'll be touching on some of these, and there's nothing here that anyone in the room I would gather has not been exposed to, but it's, again, focusing on high impact areas, using discipline, accountability, and measuring results to demonstrate our role and value. And this is relevant because these are big dollars that are at stake. So we know that one of the mantras these years that has become prevalent in the last several years has been all about the patient. We heard about patient satisfaction. Patient engagement is the new vernacular. Patient activation is another aspect of that. And how many of you have heard of choosing wisely? Quite a few, but not everybody. So Choosing Wisely is an initiative that was developed through the collaboration of 60 professional societies based on evidence-based practice to determine how resources should be used and really to engage patients in dialogue about when treatments and conditions may not be necessary. Powerful, powerful information. If you go to their website, significant number of the recommendations are medication related. And so they provide a platform for initiating dialogue with patients, as well as identifying areas of opportunity that may not have already come to the helm in your organizations, where we can manage overutilization and manage resources appropriately. One of the ones from the American Geriatric Society says, don't prescribe a medication without conducting a drug regimen review. Any of you have heard me speak about this? I've said, I think every patient needs a review at least yearly, and high-risk patients need a quarterly review, just like we do a tune-up on the car. For God's sake, we take the car in. How come we don't take patients in? So let me show you a little bit about Choosing Wisely. This is actually kind of fun. It's a YouTube video that was released to, okay, I think, is it going to go on with the sound? It might seem crazy. Whoops. We're buffering. I was going to start dancing. Sorry, you'll have to wait. I love this song, too. Technical issues. It worked this morning, so we have confidence. How many of you have seen this? Has anyone seen that yet? One? Can't see your hand. A few of you have seen it. Okay. Well, it's actually, yeah. Well, you can all, I should have just gotten everybody who's seen it get up here and dance, because it's a great song. Crazy what I'm about to say. Let this moment often be the best way.
Choosing wisely, my dreams are minor things. hall. With that procedure, you wear a hospital gown. Do nothing can be your lucky charm. They want to keep you. I said, let me tell you now.
Sorry, I was went a little long, but I thought you'd all enjoy it, and I thought it was very relevant because you can see if we think about the comments Chris made at the opening of this program today, we're more and more getting into the ambulatory world and how else to engage patients. Now, I don't suggest you show the entire video, but it does it brings talking points, and that was the purpose of this, is to really bring talking points to the clinician and to engage the patients, because they're the ones making the decisions. How many times do we all confront situations where the evidence may not support a given treatment modality, but the patient's demanding it? If there is an alignment, which there isn't in our healthcare system, and there's a minimal copay, then telling a patient, well, do you really need a proton pump inhibitor, may not go anywhere, because the patient's going to say, it's only $10 out of pocket, I don't care. Well, but what about all the unintended consequences? So really, this is focused on overuse, and in a very, I thought, kind of easy way to understand, and very relevant to the things we're all trying to do in terms of value. Choosing wisely is really intended to provide value. And you can see what I enjoyed when I saw it was there are a fair amount of medication-related things just in this video. So it's something to think about as we think about how we're relevant in our environments. So let's see if we can do our first polling question. Choosing wisely consists of evidence-based recommendations, supports patient engagement and discussion and about treatments and tests, and has many medication-related recommendations. Survey. You can use your interactive device. I'm getting pretty high up there. I made the question too easy. I really should have asked how many of you want to come up and dance to this, and to the song. Of course, then you would have been distracted and multitasking. So I think the consensus is all of the above. Okay. So I thought what I would do then is try to identify what I think are some relevant high-impact areas that we can use to demonstrate value. And I want to go over these, share what we've done, share what's going on in the pipeline, and what are some of the innovations that are occurring around the country, and hopefully give you maybe some food for thought or really validate some of the things you're doing as well. And this is really meant to look at what's going on the horizon and how do we utilize that information. Dave Zills, who is the father of forecasting, always has said you need to look at the external environment to really understand what's going on so you can more effectively strategically plan. By the way, I forgot to mention, did you see the guy in that bow tie? That was Toby Clark in the Choosing Why. I forgot to attribute that to you. That must have been you about, what, 20 years ago? Huh? Was that you? Okay, so 5 years ago? Actually, there's a whole number of people in bow ties today, so that could have been any of you as well. All right, so when we look at specialty drug spend, aka high-cost drugs, and actually look at information from managed care, so in 2013, the specialty drug spend for medical and pharmacy together, because remember, specialty drugs can either be infused or self-administered. The infused ones tend to fall under the medical benefit, and the self-administered ones tend to fall under the pharmacy benefit. So looking back just last year, the per member per year, which is essentially an aggregate of the dollar spent on individuals taking the drugs on a yearly basis, was $348. At that time, traditional drugs represented $676. It's predicted within just a couple of years, 4 years, the anticipated annual costs are going to exceed the traditional oral costs. So $846 for specialty drug spend versus $836. I actually think this number is going to go higher. I mean, if we just look at releases in the last year in the specialty drug field of really breakthrough products, I wouldn't be surprised if this is going to go higher. And remember, this only represents 1 to 5% of a population of a plan. So what's interesting is all of our organizations work to provide population health by mergers, acquisitions, buying primary care physicians' offices and the like. The big question, the elephant in the room is, so what's our adverse selection look like? You know, how did the actuaries run their numbers, but did anyone do a deep dive into this population that we just assumed a risk-based contract for to really know what the level of specialty drug spend is and what kinds of diseases are we treating? These are the questions I ask when I get into meetings with the contracts folks. Do we know what we're getting ourselves into? Because the defining moments will be as these patients come into our system and depending on how they utilize our healthcare dollars, which gives us such tremendous opportunities to think forward. Because really, for us to be successful, to provide value, we have to think forward. We still have to maintain all the things we're doing. That's not going to go away. But let's continue to think forward together. So clearly, cost savings opportunities, site of administration, we heard Linda talk about it. That's the payers are looking at that very, very in a very focused way. Infusions that have traditionally been given on site, can they be shifted to home care? Not just for certain cancer therapies, but a number of chronic diseases such as inflammatory bowel disease and the like. And then we're getting into special disease algorithms, which I call clinical pathways 2.0. And what we found in our setting, and I'm sure you're finding this in all of your settings, we need pharmacists who have the knowledge and skills. Specialty pharmacy is not just one specialty, it's multiple specialties. You get into the enzyme replacement therapies and some of the orphan diseases and the level of knowledge one needs to be able to care for these patients or to evaluate how to develop guidelines for use requires a significant body of knowledge. So I would challenge all of us to ensure that we're developing those competencies in-house. For those of you who have specialty residency trainings already in place, which I know a number of my colleagues have, thank God you're doing that. We're all going to need to be experts in these drugs because the utilization is something we can manage. And when I meet with our physicians, I say, I'm not the expert in this particular drug therapy, whether it's IBD or dealing with acute intermittent porphyria, but I'm trying to figure out how we can manage the gray, because there's the black and the white, but then there's the gray. So help me understand, based on the evidence, what are some of the things we can consider in determining where this drug where we should place this drug in therapy compared to conventional therapy. And those are the dialogues that we need to have with lots and lots of different physicians across organizations as we become risk-based, because these populations will inevitably come to our systems. And our key is the pharmacist with the clinical knowledge who can establish the credibility and, as Quinn said, the relationships. It requires those of us in leadership roles to have a fundamental understanding of what this means, but it also requires the deep knowledge and skills of, I would say, the new clinical pharmacist. The new clinical pharmacist who understands the specialty drugs and all of the implications around the immune system, because a lot of these drugs, I call them immune bartending. It's really playing with the immune system. It is. It's bartending, if you think about it. A little of this, a little of that. But it really, really does require deep, deep knowledge of how these drugs work, and I can't emphasize that enough. So just to make sure you're with me, specialty drug management strategies include developing treatment guidelines or pathways, selecting least costly site of administration, and having pharmacy specialists evaluate orders. Survey says, I really need to make the questions more complicated. This is just What was I thinking? Okay. Wanted to make sure you were all awake before lunch and get you ready for Charles Daniels' amazing presentation. So wanted to make everyone feel like they're getting an A. Okay, moving along. So let's, what did I just do? Me and technology. At least I'm not by the microphone, because you know what I do when I'm by the microphone? I hit the microphone, because I move my hands all the time. So I, you know, after a few times, the microphone's way over there and I'm over here. Okay, moving along. So here's an example of a collaboration between a health plan and Cardinal Health for rheumatoid arthritis. And so what they were able to do is develop a pathway, and they provided incentives. This is not unlike some of the things that are happening in oncology right now for the purposes of getting buy-in to the guidelines. And they were able to effectively meet their goals. And the way that these guidelines were developed is that patients had to be started on a conventional DMARD, disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drug, prior to going to a biologic. I think there's 9 biologics for RA right now. And so there was like a 12 weeks of trying a DMARD before initiation of a biologic. And they were able to see an 8% reduction in biologics. So this is just an example of the kinds of things we're going to see not only the health plans be doing, but that we should be doing ourselves as we accumulate patients where we have responsibility for a population of patients, not just for their acute care episode, but the ongoing responsibility for their care. So this was actually a good example. I'll show you an oncology one soon. Here's some of the stuff we did. We decided to be very disruptive. And because of the adverse events associated with the POET and in the oncology population, that one was pretty much nipped in the bud for us because of the risks of actually creating cancer as opposed to treating it. So we went after the non-oncologic indications, engaged our nephrologists, and decided we were going to be really disruptive. We'd done this over many years. First, we started by limiting the dose. We actually had some dose substitutions. And then we decided, well, we sat with nephrologists, also a very passionate group of people, nephrologists are. Never quite understood why. Do you all find nephrologists are passionate? They're brilliant, brilliant. I mean, when it comes to electrolytes, my goodness, they know more than anybody. But they're also passionate. And so we said, so what about if we just hold the drug for a week? Patient gets admitted, we hold it for a week. It's chronic therapy. Do they really need it in the hospital? Yes, no? If the iron stores aren't effective, it doesn't even work. Like, why are we giving Epatin to someone without iron stores? So we had already gotten approval to always order the iron store studies at the time patients were admitted on EPO, because we weren't going to go throw EPO if there wasn't any iron. So we were able to negotiate with them to start EPO on day 8, unless the hemoglobin was below 8. And we also reduced the standard to a standard dose of 50 units per kilo 3 times a week. And so what we did is essentially the principles of our engagement are develop relationships and be credible and be honest. And we were, all of those. We would say we were just trying to look at opportunities to reduce cost to the organization. By the way, this is an inpatient initiative. And got some champions. Remember, that's what Quinn said, get some champions beside you. Got the most passionate physicians to support us and implemented a protocol, basically pharmacy-run EPO. So when we get an order, this whole protocol goes into place, including how to ordering the iron panels, the results, when to give EPO. If iron's been given, we wait until after the iron's been given to even start the EPO. But you can see we saved some money here, and so this was considered pretty disruptive, but we were able to make it happen. And so examples are really important. You know, in all of our settings, we need to show examples and quantify results. This one was actually pretty easy. We were looking at our use of HBIG because we're a pretty big transplant center, and we looked at some of the UHC data that, for those of us who are University Health System Consortium members, and we were able to save a fair amount of money in a year by just reducing the number of doses. So I, as a number of you, feel that it's always good to have quantitative data where you've implemented initiative and you can show cost savings. But I believe in the stories as well. So I try to tell my staff routinely, could you collect the showstoppers, whether it's a safety, a quality, or a cost one? Because I think it's important to educate the administration, not just about the cost savings, but the level of knowledge that's needed to do these interventions. And I think that's the part that we really continue in all of our settings to need to do and to strive to do. It's about what Quinn said, it's education, but education about the level of knowledge, because this is not just processing an order and finding something ambiguous in the order. This is actually having the knowledge to know that, oh, by the way, this patient with CMV viremia doesn't need to be on CMV IVIG anymore. Or we can dose round the glucuronidase in the patient with methotrexate toxicity. Or, by the way, the patient with acute intermittent porphyria doesn't have the labs back, so why should we give the drug? We need to see the labs, and then we'll decide if the drug is needed, and then we'll call the doctor and see if we can get it DC'd. Or the patient with HIV, hepatitis C, idiopathic thrombocytic purpura, received through doses of IVIG as an outpatient, had some low platelets, the doctor wanted two more doses, but by the way, the platelets were going up, so let's get the drug DC'd. Or the last one, which is a site of care issue. This is a patient with Hunter's disease, which was admitted, and we said, well, why do we need to give it as an inpatient? Let's give it as an outpatient. So the purpose of these is not just to show, oh, wow, we saved a lot of money. Here's just a few examples. It's to show the knowledge it takes to do this. And I think that's part of this value discussion. Value has many dimensions. Yes, it can be quantified in a formula, but I think at the end of the day, we need the results, and we need to play them forward, and we need to explain what the results mean, and the bandwidth it takes to produce the results. The EPITIN only worked because the pharmacist could talk to the nephrologist in a credible way, and that requires knowledge, skills, and a foundation that no other profession represents but ours. So we need to market that more. We kind of tend to be quiet. We talk to each other. Aren't we great? We're all great. We're all here. We're happy. We're great. We need to talk to other people, and we need to share these stories beyond ourselves. So I've been particularly interested in this area of cancer because we acquired 3 cancer centers over the last 3 years, and all of a sudden it's my problem. Because one of our people said, oh my God, it's expensive. So I just sat there going, mm-hmm, yeah, that's true. Should have talked to me before you bought them all. Anyway, so I hope this isn't being taped. I need to be employed still, at least for a while. So I'm always careful. When I speak in front of audiences, I always wonder, oh my God, if any of this information goes back, I hope I still have a job. Anyway, so I particularly find cancer interesting, one, because I've pretty much been working on it for several years, and as opposed to a number of you who have had, you know, outpatient cancer centers, have built your infrastructure, have a solid platform in place, have put, you know, guidelines in place for years, have worked through all of the issues. I'm kind of a newbie to this within the last 3 years. In fact, I spent the better part of 2 of the years trying to just get one of them licensed and then one of them's not licensed, and so it's just all really interesting out there. So I collaborate with a lot of colleagues out in the audience here. But what I find interesting about cancer, and some of you may have heard me say this before, it really exemplifies everything in healthcare in one disease, everything going on. And then you look at the cost of cancer care. How many people saw 60 Minutes last week? Wasn't that phenomenal? You can actually find you can find it online. It was about financial toxicity. And it was a wonderful, wonderful 15, 20 minutes speaking to physician leadership at Sloan Kettering and at MD Anderson, really addressing what the patients are dealing with in terms of becoming bankrupt because of the cost of care and their out-of-pocket costs. And so what's happening with the Affordable Care Act is premiums have been made affordable for patients, so people can be insured, but the out-of-pocket costs, the coinsurance, the co-pays, are what's really, really affecting patients in a very, very significant way. So this is definitely worth watching. Financial toxicity was an interesting term I hadn't heard before. I actually shared it with our oncology leadership at the Cancer Quality Committee. And then I prepared this slide in August, so we weren't dealing with restricted distribution channels, which hit us all in the last few weeks, another hot topic for what is affecting our ability to provide cancer care to our patients. But if you go around this wheel, I mean, every one of these issues are relevant and important and will continue to become important as we consider what our roles are. So this is why you've probably heard me say in other forums, I think every pharmacist has to have a core understanding of cancer care, and I think every leader needs to understand this because we play a role in every one of the spokes on this wheel. And certainly the payers are really interested in this. ASCO just released a 50 or 60 or 80 page document, I can't remember how many pages because I went through it, proposing reform. And what they're proposing is that instead of, I think, 57 codes to pay for cancer care, they're proposing 11 to really address what is needed for the patient, quality indicators, as well as support of things like the Oncology Medical Home, which should be a multidisciplinary team, and efforts to reduce readmissions. So I don't know how many of you read the article a year or two ago. There was an article of predictive diseases and conditions associated with readmissions. And they used the term acronym HOSPITAL. Has anyone heard that? So you take each of the letters of HOSPITAL, and it represents a source of readmissions. So H is hyponatremia. Guess what O is? Oncology. So clearly, the discussions around transitions of care, the work we need to do in ambulatory care, needs to encompass this oncology population because they have problems understanding their complex medication regimens. They have all of the issues associated with medication lists that we know are problematic for any patient. And certainly the complexity of drug therapy as we get into biomarkers is going to continue to challenge us all and require expertise that we need to possess. And we need to understand how reimbursement is going to work for this population. So clearly, every dimension of healthcare is represented in cancer care. So just to see if you're all with me, cancer includes the following dimensions except palliative care. Actually, this is actually a false positive question. Palliative care, team-based care, nursing, guidelines, and pathways. When I read this question a couple weeks ago, I go, oh, that really wasn't the right answer, but we'll just go with it. I think we're far enough along. So most, yeah, see, that's why the answers are so strange, because the nursing really is an integral part of care. So I think when I wrote this question, I could have come up with a better response. But clearly, the focus is on the team, not on any one discipline. And there was also an article that came out of one of the Journal of Clinical Oncology recently that actually talked about why pharmacists have to be an essential part of the care of oncology patients. So the good news is, from an oncology professional perspective, we are well respected for what we provide. So we're in that area, we've done an outstanding job. So I would say that we need to do the same work in specialty pharmacy we've been doing in oncology pharmacy for the better part of the last several decades. That's where we need to go. So when we look at trends, I don't think it's a surprise to any of you. A lot of drugs in the pipeline, a lot of cost, $100 billion a year with a projected growth, double that in just a few six years from now. The big focus in some of the articles I've read is on survivorship. So there are new roles in a number of organizations of survivorship. And again, those patients need pharmaceutical care as well. And Medicare pays for almost half of it. So obviously they're interested in it. And a lot of the payment reform is around the Medicare patient. We know oral drugs can cost up to $100,000, which is a huge issue for patients with their out-of-pocket costs and oftentimes results in them self-discontinuing the medications, which is why we need to be following up with these patients. And we know that the care is often fragmented and poorly coordinated. And so having different sectors deliver cancer drugs to patients contributes to this fragmentation of care. We've seen the increase in hospital acquisitions of oncology groups. How many people have done that? Anybody else? Show your hands. How many people have acquired oncology groups recently? So quite a few smattering across. Of course, this is causing the payers pain because they say we're too expensive. That's why we need to engage with them and help them understand how we really are effectively trying to manage utilization through guidelines and such. The concern is that for hospitals, especially like mine, you may know we're in West Los Angeles. People say we're in Beverly Hills. Well, not quite, but we are a large hospital. Almost 900 beds and a very big hospital with all private rooms. So our biggest risk is that we're going to be carved out of a network. I think part of the rationale of acquiring oncology groups was there wouldn't be that many left, so they'd have to work with us. But it was really for a broader reason of really trying to be able to provide a good research platform to try to find cures for cancer. And we've got some phenomenal physicians to work with. But we have everybody competing with us in this space to try to provide this care. And so we have the retail sector, freestanding infusion centers, and again, those MD offices that are still standing are trying to provide care as well. So there have been a number of Institute of Medicine reports on this subject, and some of the key themes were, we all know the inappropriate financial incentives. Physicians have been reimbursed by providing more chemotherapy, the buy and bill model. The more you get, the more you bill, the more you get paid, the more expensive drug, the more you get paid. So if Medicare reimburses at average sales price plus 4.3% or 6%, depending on if you're thinking about sequestration or not, a more expensive drug is going to give them a bigger margin. And so there's this belief that that's driven some of the overuse of agents. We've certainly seen that in some of the agents we've explored as we've gotten and looked under the hood in the cancer centers. There's also unrealistic expectations in terms of what is the dialogue between patients and clinicians. And so our organization is, and I'm sure a lot of yours are doing a lot in the area of advanced directives, really trying to engage patients in understanding what is the expected outcome. I'll talk a little bit more about what we're doing in this realm with respect to performance status and chemotherapy. And we know that overuse and misuse of resources and inadequate adherence of treatment guidelines is a huge area of focus and opportunity. And the report also said there's really not a lot of evidence of what represents high-quality, affordable cancer care. So the movement, the big movement across ASCO and across all the payers is standardization of care, clinical pathways and guidelines. And to the extent that people have implemented electronic health records, this is possible because one can build those guidelines into your electronic health record. Harvey Feinberg, who's the physician chairman of the Institute of Medicine, or president rather, said, if we can find a way to solve this problem for cancer care, we have the keys to solve it for healthcare more broadly. And I think those statements are very relevant given all of the dimensions. So the people in the UK have a different methodology for how they determine what's available to treat patients in the UK. And so among the questions that gets asked says, does median survival of 1 or 2 months at a cost of up to $100,000 represent value? So in the UK, they have this organization called NICE, which if you speak to any clinicians in the US, say, not so nice, because they really have pretty rigorous processes for determining what they're going to pay for. Now, they're revisiting this as well. But suffice it to say that their threshold for drug approval for cancer is about $30,000 to $50,000 for each quality-adjusted life year added by an intervention. They've actually gone a little higher and gone up another $16,000. This is U.S. dollars. I translated the pounds to dollars. So that's their threshold. So how many of you read the indication-based pricing for cancer article that came out in JAMA about a week ago? Did anybody read that? It's a really interesting article. So what they did is they took a little different approach than the NICE people. And this was actually spearheaded by the physician who's also on the 60 Minutes report, who's the health services researcher, health services outcome physician at Sloan Kettering. And so they came up with a model where they took the Medicare reimbursement, and then they looked at the evidence supporting additional years of life gained by therapy, and then they backed into what the pricing should be based on what the likelihood of survival was given a drug for different indications. So they took paclitaxel, and they said if you give paclitaxel for breast cancer, and then they used the standard of $150,000 for every additional year of life. They came up with that standard. So if $150,000 per additional year of life was kind of the standard. So paclitaxel for breast cancer met that threshold. But for non-small cell lung cancer, the cost for each additional year was $400,000. And they basically then came up with what the drug should be priced for based on the data that demonstrates survival, looking at some of these economics. Fascinating article. It's a great read, just if anything else. So you can sit there, make sure you drink it in the morning, read it in the morning after you had a cup of coffee. Do not read it after a drink, because you have to really, it's actually brilliant mathematical modeling to determine how they came up with these schematics. But their suggestion is we should really pay for cancer care based on the likelihood of achieving benefit, meaning progression-free survival of a year. Because some of the studies we're seeing are 42 days, 30 days. In these two cases, they cited savings based on a percentage of a year, and that's how they came up with the numbers. So I think for non-small cell lung cancer, the increased life was 0.08 years, which is why when they did the translation, it came out to $400,000. So take a look at it. If my math is not quite right, I did my best to interpret the article for you. This would be a great journal club article for residency programs, but it actually starts to show you what we're probably going to be faced with in probably the not-too-distant future in making decisions as new therapeutic entities come to market to figure out what their value is to the patients and what their cost is going to be to our healthcare systems. Now, the flip side of this is the toxicity part, because not all of these new entities are not with out toxicity. And I don't think that's always well explained to our patients. And so we get into a lot of dialogue. We have a multidisciplinary, we actually call it the High Cost Cancer Committee that we kicked off about a year and a half ago, where we get into this dialogue about some of the off-label uses that are being demanded by patients who are very well-read and on the internet, but may extend life, we don't know for sure, but could also reduce their life or increase the likelihood of an adverse event that would result in an admission. And then what do we do? And then what do we do if the patient's a cash patient? Those are the kinds of discussions we're going to be having. Bill Zellmer challenged me to think about the ethical dilemmas we're going to be having as a profession going forward, and I told him that was one I just dealt with within the last week. And I think we're all going to be dealing with this as we go forward. So the American Society of Clinical Oncology, as I told you, is really exploring this. They have proposed a new methodology for reimbursement that was just released in May, and they are developing indicators to look at all of these different dimensions of cancer care with the goal of having value algorithms. So we just saw an example of results associated with bundled payments. It was published in the Journal of Oncology Practice in July. And this was a pilot that United Healthcare did in collaboration with physicians with the focus on breast, colon, and lung cancer. And I call this a preview of coming attractions because I think we're going to see more of this. So it was a bundled payment for treatment episodes aligned with physician incentives. So in other words, using higher cost chemo didn't mean there was more reimbursement. They had a number of measures of cost, quality, and use, survival, time to progression, and time to progression and survival, use of colony stimulating factors, ED visits and admissions, or treatment symptoms, delays in hospice. And what the results were kind of surprising. So they had an overall reduction in cost of care of 34%. But interestingly, the drug costs went up. So this is actually a true pharmacoeconomic evaluation. And the implications of it, I think, are yet to be seen, but it's the first of its kind. They absolutely saw a decrease in hospitalization and this use of what I call therapeutic, I called it imaging radiology. One of the comments was there was a delay in post-discharge follow-up with resulting readmissions. And I went, aha, that's where we belong. We belong in that space. Post-discharge follow-up of oncology patients needs to be a priority in our transitions of care initiatives. We know these patients are at risk for all of the things I showed you in the spokes on the wheel. Health literacy, adherence, toxicity management, all of the things, cost, out-of-pocket costs, helping them figure that out. But this was the first of its kind, and as I said, I think we're going to see more and more of this in the future as we get into risk-based contracting. So here's what we did. We established our committee, and I was going through our fiscal year end a few months ago and said, okay, how did we do? So these, in two of our cancer centers, the third one just came on board within this year, so we haven't really done a deep dive in there yet. But in two of them, we developed and implemented supportive care guidelines. I'm sure those of you who've had these cancer centers did this years ago. But we also got into the realm of bone modifying agents, and I learned all sorts of things like time to skeletal event and what that means and how to develop criteria for use. I always had my oncology specialty folks with me, but we were able to negotiate restrictions on some of the bone modifying agents. We realized that $1.25 million this first year. When we took over this initiative in January 13, I remember I was asked by the leadership, okay, how much do you think we'll save? I said, I don't know, unmanaged programs, $60 million, 5%, $3 million. So they looked at me and they said, $3 million? I said, yeah, $3 million. And they said, how can you say that? I said, I don't know. It's just I think that if we start getting in there and looking and talking to the physicians and being really transparent about the fact that we need to start positioning ourselves for a competitive marketplace, we're a high-cost provider, we're going to develop disease-related, we had these disease, we call them disease research groups, which are really developing cancer-specific guidelines by diseases. We'll do some dose rounding. We'll start looking at performance status. I think we can save about $3 million. So we came in $4.2 million under budget. And they said, how did you do that? I said, we just talked a lot. I tell you, the way we do things, we try to establish credible relationships, bring people with expertise, have dialogue, consensus, and exhaust people. I think really exhausting. It's like one more meeting. It's like, oh, God, is she going to talk again? But anyway, it worked. So I don't, you know, I don't question success. If it works, it works. We actually have the data broken down by the different supportive care guidelines where we came up with a 1.25. Some of the other ones are a little harder to measure. But I think part of it was shining a light on it, to tell you the truth, because a number of you have managed cancer programs for many, many years, and you might not get these results because you've done a great job. For us, it was shining a light on something that had been totally unmanaged and putting some rigor in place and starting to really ask for evidence. So here's one of the ones we also kicked off that's still a work in progress, but this one's a very important one, and it relates to all of the issues that organizations across the country are dealing with end-of-life care, and in the oncology populations is a particular issue. So among the ASCO Choosing Wisely 10 guidelines, of which several are medication-related, if you haven't looked at them and you're trying to look at opportunities in your oncology programs, I would direct you to look at them because they can actually help you support the things you're probably trying to do anyway. But this was one in particular where we wanted to look at performance status because, in fact, the ASCO Choosing Wisely states, do not use cancer-directed therapy for solid tumor patients with the following characteristics. Low performance status, ECOG 3 or 4. I'll show you ECOG in a minute. 5 is dead. In our organization, we probably still give IVs to those patients. So we felt it was important to look at this. And we did have a physician champion. Remember, Quinn said that that's really, really important. Our physician champion is an ovarian cancer specialist. So she understands this very well because she deals with it all the time. And it was based on a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine on metastatic non-small cell lung cancer that demonstrated that patients receiving early palliative care had less aggressive care at the end of life, but improved their quality of life and longer survival, which means that people with poor performance status live longer and have a better quality of life if we don't give them chemo, because then they don't get all the toxicities. So we decided to take this ball and run with it. I heard her present this at a meeting a couple years ago, and I said, gee, Dr. Carlin, what about if we start integrating performance status into chemotherapy ordering forms? It's a point in time to think about it and talk about it. Now, ideally, they've had an advanced directive and a discussion about treatment options and likelihood of surviving their cancer. But even if they don't, why don't we at least integrate it into the chemotherapy order form? So for those of you who don't know what the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group scores are, they're pretty straightforward. And we actually engaged our nursing staff in also being educated about this and using this as well so that there was some level of reliability. If the physician scored the patient low and the nurse thought the patient was much higher in the ECOG score, then they would intervene. And so we really have made this part of how we provide cancer treatment in our organization across inpatient and outpatient sites. And we integrated into the oral chemotherapy ordering for patients who are admitted. Guess what we found? Patients are admitted on oral chemo. Whoever's admitting the physician just does what on the electronic health record, presses continue. And what we found was oftentimes it was a hospitalist who may not have the knowledge of that chemotherapy or understand what the potential side effects were. So when we brought this forward and found that a number of the patients who had poor ECOG status were actually being continued on oral chemotherapy by hospitalists or internal medicine physicians or even surgeons who just click continue, this created an entire uproar in the organization and then created an impetus for actually privileging anyone that can order chemo, oral. We'd always had a pretty good handle on the parenteral chemo, but the oral chemo was coming in because cancer is a chronic disease and people are staying on oral chemotherapy for life. And so for our organization, you may have already put this in place, created this whole need to privilege physicians to order oral chemo, which was interesting. So the oncologists took this forth. They felt very strongly that only oncologists should order oral chemo, created a big uproar with medical staff because of the number of physicians who were involved, and said, Rita, can you come to the meeting to speak about it? And it's like, me? Why me? But I went with them, and it was a very interesting discussion, and they just asked me, so is this true, Rita? This is what happens? And I said, yes, it does. It happens every day. So we actually have a privileging process in place. So we've been collecting the data, and we've actually done pretty well with getting the scores. So we have what we call chemotherapy stewardship. I'm copying all of you, antimicrobial stewardship, Wisconsin's anticoagulation stewardship. I'm calling it chemotherapy stewardship. Decided to copy everybody else. But what we're doing here is when there's an order where the ECOG score exceeds 2, the pharmacist engages the physician in dialogue and then calls another physician reviewer to discuss the case to see if it should be continued. We don't have definitive results in this yet, but the belief based on the oncologist I spoke with last week is that people are not initiating chemo because they don't want to deal with the if they have a patient who's not who's faring poorly, they don't always initiate the chemo because they recognize they need to wait to determine whether or not the chemo is indicated. From my perspective, this is an important way to add value because actually this is relevant. It's relevant to the patients, first and foremost. It's relevant to their families. It's relevant to our organizations. And at the end of the day, it's important from a cost perspective as well. So we're also tracking, we also are involved in that Dartmouth Atlas that Quinn alluded to. So we do look at patients dying in the hospital with a chemo diagnosis, patients who are admitted within 14 days of the end of life. And that's reviewed by our Cancer Quality Committee. And that's part of the work that we're involved in so we can understand the whole process. So here's another question. Episode-based reimbursement for oncology provides pharmacists with opportunities to develop disease-specific guidelines, develop supportive care guidelines, integrate performance status into chemotherapy decision-making, all of the above. Okay, that was an easy one, too. Okay, so I'm not going to talk a lot about antimicrobial stewardship. I think people have been doing this for many, many years. Certainly the CDC and the WHO have shined a light on it, and it's become a much more an issue. But oh my God, the IDSA statement on this is probably, 5 to 7 years old, if not longer. Suffice it to say that this continues to be an important area in all of our organizations, and I think it's one where we can very, very readily show impact in terms of what we do, not only for antimicrobials resistance, but for the bottom line. So I put this up there just to remind everyone, this is a great example of things that probably all of you are doing at some level. I think what to me is important goes back again to the fundamental way that we can accomplish anything in our profession. We've got to have the people who have the core competency. And it's not just the specialists in antimicrobial therapy. It's all pharmacists. This is core. Just like I believe specialty pharmacy needs to be core, just like I believe oncology needs to be core. There need to be people who have the highest level expertise, clearly. But there are certain things as we think about what do we need as a workforce to really practice at the top of our license. There are some fundamental knowledge and skills that pharmacists need to provide to be able to have effective conversations with prescribers, because the ability to change therapy is one pharmacist at a time communicating with a provider at a time. And that so it falls on us to ensure that we provide that competency, whether it's within our organizations or through ASHP or another way. So the last one I want to talk about, which I know there's a whole breakout session today and tomorrow, and I know this is top of mind of a lot of you. I know there are people in this room who've done amazing work, published on it, have results, just like Linda had. So I'm not here to necessarily show you anything new, but maybe package it in a little different way from my perspective of why this is important. So when we look at the traditional medication use process, quality and safety have been foremost. We've focused our energies. Clinical pharmacy grew up. Clinical pharmacy grew up focusing on. Okay, let's try to do this. Prescribing. Just work with me here. And monitoring. And then over the course of the last 20 years, with the advent of technology, we've certainly learned and developed processes within the pharmacy operations itself to automate and leverage technology to support the medication use process and operations so that we can safely and effectively deliver medications to patients. But this has really been what traditionally I grew up with, the medication use process, and it's one simple slide. But if we think forward, it's really about the patient-centered perspective. So I would just challenge us to think about medication use process 2.0, which takes all of the aspects of the medication use process, all of the steps, and starts to look at them in the context of the patient as they come into our organizations, transfer through different levels of care, and either go home, go to the doctor's office, or go to a skilled nursing facility or some other long-term care facility. This is the medication use process. And one of the things I've been trying to do for the last few years with our staff is to educate them to think this way. It's not just that episode of care. It's not just the acute care medication orders and the transactions and the amazing things we do on a daily basis to prevent harm because of orders that are unclear or are not appropriate in the context of the patients. Pharmacists understand context, but we also understand, we need to understand the patient context. So I would say that, at least in my career, I spent the better part of my career really trying to develop an understanding of how pharmacists and health systems really look at the whole patient. That's my mantra. We look at the whole patient, we evaluate the drug therapy in the context of that patient's episode, and we do our best to ensure the safety and quality of that, of the care of the patient, right? Now I'm trying to explain, we need to look at that acute care episode in the context of the patient. So it's a little bit of a shift. And it does require kind of thinking differently. And I can tell you from the standpoint of pharmacists who've practiced in our organization who are outstanding clinicians, this is a little bit of a shift in them. Little is probably an underestimate. It's a change. It's a change because the patient's acute care needs are still need to be resolved. The reason they were admitted still needs to be addressed. And how we do this and how we organize ourselves is a subject of discussion, and some of you have done in different ways. But I think this is something we need to think about. And I would argue that this is medication use process 2.0. So I want to introduce you to my friend Mitzi Medson. So Mitzi is an employee of Cedars-Sinai. She worked for 45 years in food services, retired, and has gone to our employee wellness clinic, so she always carries a medication list with her. But as every patient, she sometimes gets confused. And we know that understanding adherence, literacy and adherence are a huge issue with patients. The dollars have been estimated to be $100 billion per year in medication-related admissions. In 2011, Chowdhury et al. Published a study in the New England Journal of Medicine where they gave free drug to patients post-MI to see if it would improve adherence. So the results demonstrated they did have an improvement in adherence, about 4 to 6%. Even then, compared to patients with a traditional copay. Even then, in the cohort that had free drug, 50% of the patients weren't adherent. And the conclusions were, patients need active follow-up. Well, who should be doing that active follow-up? Us. So Mitzi, and we'll come back to Mitzi. Mitzi's become my poster child. I actually presented to our health system managers about how important it is that everyone who's on medications or who has a family on medications ensures the accuracy of the medication list. And I'll show you why. And we'll talk some more about Mitzi because she's become my best friend. So why does medication literacy matter? This is from my employee wellness pharmacist. The instructions are 3 times a day. This is what the patient said. I'm taking the medication at 8, 9, and 10. My friend is getting 100 milligrams for his blood pressure. Why am I only getting 5? I've got my physician's not prescribing appropriately. Or I'm taking both pravastatin and pantoprazole. Pantoprazole is for my high cholesterol, and pravastatin is for my acid reflux, which I only take as needed. Real life stories happens everywhere, every day. Literacy matters. And so one of the things I've undertaken in our organization is to educate decision makers who are non-clinicians about why literacy matters. We're actually trying to figure out how to measure it, and we'll show you some of the results. So MedRec is my favorite topic. Some of you may have heard me say it. So those of you who haven't heard me say it before, so at least I'm getting some laughs. So this is what I call it in our organization, MedRec, because it sounds good. But do you know that world hunger would be easier if we drop food on different parts of the world where patients get food? People would eat. Some people would eat. With medication lists, you really never know what's in that list. You don't know the last person who took the history. You don't know if they were qualified. You don't know if the patient was able to articulate what they were on. How much money have we spent on healthcare-acquired infections in this country to prevent healthcare-acquired infections? So why don't we consider medication lists as contaminated too? They are. They're contaminated. We don't know the last person who touched it and what they introduced, right? So think about that. So here's the data, very, very robust body of evidence showing the number of errors. I think Quinn represented some of the work that Utah's done. Those of you who've been doing transitions of care work have your own set of data. 1/3 of patients had a medication error admission. 85% had errors that originated from their prior to admission medication history. 54 to 86% of patients have discrepancies in medications upon admission. Even a bigger number, estimated 3.3 discrepancies per patient. 14 to 80% of patients experienced at least one medication discrepancy post-discharge. 19% of patients experienced an adverse drug event within 3 weeks of hospital's discharge. 67% were attributed to medications, and 12% were preventable. So the numbers are really clear. So why don't we own this? Why don't we as a profession own this? That's my burning platform now. And I will talk to anyone who wants to hear about it. So I see Amy Gutierrez in the audience, I believe, and so she's had to hear me talk about it. So you don't have to hear it again because you've heard this already. She's actually, she has a leadership role on our state board of pharmacy, so she's had to hear me talk about this. Sorry to pull you out of the audience. Pardon? This is an abbreviated version. So medication lists generated by electronic health records are generally accurate. True or false? Okay, you've got to get the right answer here. Okay, some people think they're true. Maybe you have robust, wonderful processes in place. So I learned this from Toby Clark. Sorry to pick on you again, Toby. A medication order is a sentence. I have quoted you now for 15 years on this one because I don't believe people outside of our profession understand this. And if any element of the sentence is inaccurate or incorrect or ambiguous, we know we can have patient harm. Think about wrong routes. Think about sustained release versus immediate release dosage forms. Think about frequencies. Any of this can cause harm. And who else knows this but pharmacy folks? Not very many people. And as I've said, a variety of individuals enter this information to the medical records. So meaningful use actually facilitated this. Because in order for physicians to get the dollars to adopt electronic health records, there are incentives for that. And I'll show you why what some of the CMS meaningful use provisions, what else was a part of that whole process. So in an article by Kwan, they actually were able to evaluate a body of literature, and they say that clinicians rely on the information and prescribe medications that are listed, even though the information may not be accurate. There's that great continue button. So what happened in 2012? So as part of meaningful use, in 2012, CMS stated that any licensed healthcare professional and credentialed medical assistants can enter orders into the medical record. A credentialed medical assistant was either someone who went to an accredited school, where they have 2 to 6 units of pharmacology. I actually went and had one of my residents check all of the curriculum for some of the schools to say, okay, how much pharmacology do the accredited schools provide? And at least in California, for 4 of the schools, it was 2 to 6. For those who didn't graduate from accredited school, they just had to take an order entry course. So I went to look at, okay, so what's that mean? So they had to have 2 years of recent experience in a healthcare facility under the supervision of a licensed healthcare provider, an attestation from a LHP, and then these are the 5 courses. Does anybody see pharmacology on here? Clinical lab testing, disease screening, legal aspects of patient care documentation, lost in translation, eliminate medical errors, and medical records of vital wave. So that's what it takes to enter medications into medical records in any doctor's office anywhere in the country. Now, I'm not here to say that we're going to put pharmacists and techs in every doctor's office. That would be irresponsible and not very realistic. However, this is important. And the reason I started to look at this is, so we had a patient admitted with methotrexate 10 milligram daily. Pharmacist caught it. So we went back to see how did it get in there. And sure enough, it was in a private doctor's office, and it was a medical assistant who put the order in. And so that's why I say we've spent how much money on healthcare-acquired infections and universal precautions to ensure that we don't contaminate patients when they come to our hospitals. What have we done to ensure that medication lists aren't contaminated when patients are admitted? Now, a number of us have initiatives in place. A number of you have done amazing work to get at medication lists, pharmacy students, technicians, ensuring that you get to 100% of lists. Not all of us are able to do that. I haven't been able to get to 100%. But clearly, we need to own those medication lists because in the Kwan article, what was said, which is what I've seen in my experience, errors introduced in any of these settings can become hardwired into the patient record. And if you look at the variety of settings, there are lots of different people who may have varying knowledge or skills or time or the ability to do this. So when we talk to like our ED nurses, they're busy trying to deal with that ED admission. They're not going to put the time into collecting an accurate list like a member of our pharmacy staff, well, a student, a technician, or a pharmacist or a pharmacy resident. And then we have the medical assistants in doctor's offices all over the country. So the concern is that once the enters once an error is introduced, it becomes hardwired. That's the same reason we have males with normal breast exams and females with normal prostate exams in our medical records. We've had that. I'm sure some of you have as well. So what makes us unique? So this is when I talk about context, the context of what we do in health system practice. Because of the access to information, because of our knowledge and skills, we look at the many dimensions of that patient before we press that verify button. That's what differentiates us from every other profession. That's why I say to our COOs, see, it's a three-legged stool. You need to have the physician and you need to have the nurse. But without the pharmacist, you cannot ensure that that medication list is accurate, nor can you ensure the safety of the medication use process. And the last time I checked, most stools don't do very well with just two legs. So he's kind of ruminating on that idea. He's got this vision of a stool. But this is something we all know, and we need to make sure it's clear as we educate. The context of the patient, the context of the patient, not just while they're in our health systems, but as they move through our health systems. This is our value. So this is just a slide I use to educate non-pharmacists and other people in our organization about safe medication transitions and how this has to occur at every episode, at every encounter, at the beginning, throughout the hospitalization, at the end. Nothing that you folks don't know. So let's go back to Mitzi. So Mitzi's been in and out of the hospital. As I told you, she worked for 40 years and then she retired and has seen many, knows all of the good doctors at Cedars, so she goes to specialists all the time. She carries her med list with her whenever she can. Sometimes she's able to go home. Unfortunately, you can see in the one of the examples, she went off to the nursing facility. She's still holding on to her medication list. But the problem was, once she left, there were different people who were touching her medication list at each encounter. So this causes all sorts of concern, because how do we know that medication list is accurate? So recently she was hospitalized with an adverse drug event, and the reason it's blurred is because it's a selfie. And she was having an adverse drug event, so she couldn't see very well. But this happens every day in every hospital everywhere. Patients with inaccurate medication list being hospitalized, potentially having an adverse drug event, but nobody really knows what they're on, unless you're in one of the wonderful hospitals represented here that's managed to figure out how to do this for their high-risk patients, or for all of their patients for that matter. This has to be something we take ownership of, and we've got to figure out how to promulgate regulations, if we can, to make this happen, because guess what? The doctors don't have time to do it. They're busy taking care of the patients. The nurses don't have time, nor do they have the knowledge and skills. And who else but we know that a medication order is a sentence? This is our value. So one of the things we're trying to do at our organization and hoping we can do with others as well is really understand it, really try to get a handle on this adherence literacy issue, because we do believe, and the evidence shows, is that when patients don't know about their medications, they don't take them properly. So we're working with a scale that's partially been developed with the Morisky scale that's validated. We've worked with Dr. Morisky to get permission to use his scale. It's a very simple four-question scale. And we've developed our own literacy scale that we're refining that he's also approved us using to try to see, gee, could we identify the patients at highest risk of readmission post-discharge? Because even all the high-risk patients is more than we can get to. Can we identify the ones at highest risk? So we came up with this algorithm. Actually, it was done by two of my residents, one who's now one of our transitions of care pharmacists. And we call it the MEDL, Medication Adherence and Literacy. Her name is Zaitseva. MEDL sounds easier, don't you think? And so we actually did some studies with the MEDL to see whether it helps us identify patients at risk for readmission, our primary objective to see is it an effective predictor tool. And then, if post-discharge interventions impact 30-day readmission rate for patients we identify. So here are our results. So we applied the MEDL. This is a cohort of 278 patients. We used our hospital service and identifies patients as high risk using usual criteria, greater than 10 meds, CHF, et cetera, et cetera. And so what we found initially is that for the patients who needed post-discharge were more likely to be readmitted. So for the ones who scored having high literacy and or high adherence on the MEDL, their admission rate was only 10%. But the ones who needed post-discharge follow-up based on the MEDL, their admission rate was 24%. Then we went ahead and did follow-up, and we found that for those that we did follow-up on, these are the patients with low adherence and low literacy, their readmission rate was only 14% versus 41% for the ones we weren't able to get to. So this did not reach statistical significance yet. We're actually trying to do a larger study to power this. But the tool was predictive, and that was statistically significant. It showed that the odds of readmission for the group identified as needing post-discharge follow-up based on low literacy and low adherence were 2.8 times greater than for the group who did not need it. So we're feeling that this is a way to risk stratify, and for those of us who may not have abundant resources or may have limited resources, it's a way to try to stratify even the high-risk patients to figure out those that might benefit the most from a pharmacist because of the need to improve their literacy first and adherence. Now, a number of you have done outstanding work with pharmacy students who are there educating your patients throughout their admission, do outstanding work in discharge counseling. Our organization is kind of a hybrid. We're an acute tertiary care teaching hospital, 2,000 private attending physicians. Try to corral a discharge process that actually is deliberate and we actually know about ahead of time is a challenge we're still facing. We're not there yet, but some of you have done a great job in this place, so I'm not going to suggest that everyone needs to do this. But for us, it was a way to risk stratify and use what we have, which is not unlimited resources, to get at the patients who might have the most value. We've also done a study on our post-discharge follow-up, looking at patients that were high risk, again, demonstrating a 45% relative risk reduction. This was part of another study we did, so it wasn't powered for statistical significance, but does show that we did have a reduction in readmissions for those patients who had post-discharge follow-up. So this is the problem. The patients go home with the meds. See all the meds in her list? Can you see her meds? She's got a whole bag of meds there. And then she's got all these meds in her medicine cabinet, and she and her husband are now both confused. So we have a responsibility. Our patients are vulnerable when they come in the hospital, but they're vulnerable when they leave too. And we do have a responsibility, whether it's through our own resources, collaboration with other entities in the healthcare world, to try to make sure that someone does follow up with our patients. I firmly believe this is a responsibility we need to think about and undertake to contribute to our patient, the care of our patients first and foremost, but to provide value. So some of our results, we just completed a randomized controlled trial, which was conducted by a physician investigator with a pharmacist, technician, and usual care to look at the number of errors per high-risk medication list. If you remember a few slides ago, I showed you and the data shows about 3.3 errors per medication list. This is based on a high-risk population, so it met our high-risk population criteria. And so we saw 7 errors per list for usual care. And so now we've been collecting data on high-risk medication lists since 2011, and no matter what cohort we look at, whether it's a general high-risk ED population, an OR population, it's always 7. And this is a randomized controlled trial, so I can tell you it's 7. 50 to 60% of the drug-related problems identified were serious or life-threatening. Then in terms of our post-discharge follow-up of high risks with a focus on adherence and literacy, we found a 50 to 60% of those high-risk patients do have this problem of low adherence and literacy. 2.1-fold readmissions for patients who had follow-up compared to those who did not. Average of 2 serious drug-related problems resolved at discharge or post-discharge. And on our skilled nursing population, which we also have a post-discharge follow-up program with 7 of our SNFs, 50% of patients required intervention due to serious drug-related problems. Now, the other metric that we're collecting is potential admission, medication-related admissions avoided, where we document those follow-ups that were really serious and ask a physician to independently review whether that patient would be readmitted. So in addition to tracking readmissions, we're looking at potential readmissions intercepted. That's running at about 16%. So just to give you that was the quantitative, I always believe, and I've heard a number of you in here and in other meetings, we'd like to tell the stories too, because the stories become relevant. The numbers say one dimension of what we do, and I think we do need to collect the metrics to show results. But the stories matter too. So in this case, we had 2 patients where we had post-discharge follow-up. One was a 94-year-old with a history of sickle cell crisis and a left parietal stroke, went home and discontinued all the meds she was supposed to be on. So we contacted the physician and made sure the patient restarted. Another was a patient with altered med status, a myriad of medical problems, and went home and stopped taking all the medications they were supposed to be on. So the opposite. They were like enantiomers of each other. But it just shows, had we not called, what would have happened? How would we know if these patients would have known what to do? And we know that the focus on the frail elderly is one that we're seeing throughout the country. This is our skilled nursing experience. Patient discharge, 98-year-old discharge with an order for a fentanyl patch, 50 micrograms. And the skilled nursing facility didn't even know the patient had it on them. So we started our post-discharge follow-up call to skilled nursing facilities last January as a pilot project that my management resident did, and it ended up being hardwired. She actually created her job the following year because she's doing this half time. Second patient was a patient who had catheter-related sepsis and needed to be on vanco with dialysis, but there was no vanco order when the patient went to dialysis. So had we not followed up, that patient would have been readmitted. So I'm sure you all have these stories too. I would just encourage you to share them if you're not already sharing them. This is what gets attention. When I share them, I do communicate in lay terms, but we try to really show what happens, not just the numbers of readmissions that may have gone down, but what happens. And again, another opportunity to show the knowledge that we have that enables us to really identify the problems that potentially another member of the healthcare team might not know. It's our advanced knowledge and skills that enables us to create this value to our patients. So I think as we look at how we transform from an acute care focus to a patient-centered focus, we really have to figure out how to do both. It's kind of an integration, and I'm finding this is something that, even as I've said in my own staff, it's kind of a mindset change from the way that they've thought before. They need to think about not only what are we doing today to take care of this patient's condition, how are we going to keep this patient safe when they leave. The layered learning models a number of you have implemented are really best practice innovation in engaging students and residents and as well as leveraging pharmacy technicians to make these programs work are phenomenal. I've learned so much from these meetings and from what I've read from all of you. Technicians can play a really, really strong role, especially if they've been trained, and they actually do a better job, as our randomized controlled trial shows and will be published, than usual care, which is a nurse or a physician. Team-based care models clearly is the way of the future, and we need to understand what population health means, and in a population health world, we have to be in this space. So, in conclusion, I'm going to try to sum up what I think Quinn started with, actually what Chris started with, what Quinn continued, and what I think is important in kind of thinking this through. We need to be relevant. Remember, he said we need to be aligned. We need to figure out the high-impact areas. I think the high-impact areas I described are probably not dissimilar than yours. You may have different ones depending on your organization. We need subject matter experts. We need those clinical specialists who have the deep knowledge and skills to create the credible relationships. And we need leaders who understand the subject matter in a way that they can converse in them. We need metrics. We have to have metrics. They need to be explicit. We need to have owners of them, and we need to have timetables. So all of us, and a lot of you in the room who are colleagues and friends I've had for years, we have just amazing ideas about what to measure and how to measure. But then, who does it by when? Are we disciplined enough? Do we have a disciplined enough focus? We're all disciplined. We wouldn't be pharmacists, for God's sake. We're the most disciplined profession there ever is. You know, when it comes to medication orders, we're extremely disciplined. But are we disciplined about setting timetables and owning the metrics we need to collect to be able to demonstrate to our organizations our contributions on making the organization thrive? Do we do that in a way that we can say we do consistently? And do we tell the stories that go with the metrics? We need to do both. That's the only way we're going to show the results, because results matter, and they're going to matter even more in the future as we compete for healthcare dollars within our own organizations. And that's how we provide value. Thank you. Okay.